In the beginning, Ibiza's ancient wells were sacred places of fertility, life and renewal, temples to the moon goddess Tanit. But slowly the people started forgetting, and the more they worshipped the god of the sun, the more the wells began to dry. You're listening to The Wells of Tanit, a podcast celebrating the folklore, mythology, history and ecology of the island of Ibiza. My name is Joanna Ruby. I'm an artist and puppeteer and the founder of Theatre of the Ancients, and we're about to journey together to one of Ibiza's wells to see what stories it has to tell us. Don't be afraid, take my hand, and let's go and find the Wells of Tanit. What I saw was just one eye in the dawn as I was going. A bird can carry all the sky in that little button glowing. Never in my life I went so deep into the firmament. He was standing on a tree, all in blossom overflowing. And he purposefully looked hard at me, at first, as if to question merrily, "Where are you going?" But next, some far more serious thing to say, I could not answer, could not look away. Oh, that hard, round, and so distracting eye, little mirror of all sky. And then the aftersong, another tree, held and sent radiating back on me. If no man had invented human word, and a bird song had been the only way to utter what we mean, what would we men have heard? What understood? What seen? Between the trills and pauses, in between the singing and the silence of a bird. That was The Bird at Dawn by Harold Munro. And it's not so much later after dawn here, between San Lorenzo and San Miguel in the north of Ibiza, where the sky is a very pale blue, and just on the edge at the forested hill, there's a brighter area where the sun is shortly going to push up above, and from then on, the heat will arrive. But in the meantime, I'm enjoying the coolness of this early morning, surrounded by red earth fields, very dry and empty, mostly filled with tiny threads of dry, dead grass. Behind me are some grapevines, a carob tree. Near me there's a trio of olive tree stumps. And just beside me on my right-hand side, I'm touching a heavy stone rectangular trough, which is still pleasantly cool this morning. And in front of me is a giant hand-sculpted gleaming white egg with a huge arched dark hole in the middle, an entrance, a doorway. And on the ledge going into the dark chamber inside, there is a large plastic water bottle with a tiny bit of water at the bottom, and the plastic handle is attached to a rope, and the rope leads up to a wooden, a beautiful carved wooden pulley. I wonder if I can make it make a sound. There's the pulley. And if I drop the plastic water bottle on the rope, down the hole, maybe we can see what happens when it reaches the bottom. Down it goes. Oh, goodbye, bottle. Vertigo disappearing into the black mouth. Wow. It's gone very, very far down, and I haven't heard it hitting water. I don't know whether that's because there's no water in the well, or if it's just very, very deep. There's been no splashing sound as it reached the water, which is quite unusual for this well. It's the first time that I haven't heard it. Wow, the rope has reached the very, very end. I didn't expect it would go so deep. And right at the very, very end, there is a tiny, tiny splashing sound of the bottle hitting water at the very, very bottom. I don't know whether you can hear it. Which confirms that the water level is lower than I've ever known it. And we'll be talking about that shortly. So I've released the bottle into the depths of the Pou de Albarqueta, the well which I know fondly as the egg-shaped well. It's on the roadside beside a winding little road that goes from San Lorenzo to San Miguel, and it stands out as a gleaming white egg on the side of the road. Its exterior is this gorgeous, gorgeous, hand-sculpted, slightly uneven, organically shaped, whitewashed dome. And it's shortly after 7 a.m. The sun will be coming up above the hill any moment now, which will drastically change this lovely cool climate this morning. And I'm now going to go to the back of the egg-shaped dome, to talk a little bit more to you. So we're walking round the back, walking past my bike, going over a little bit of wire fence, I'm sure nobody minds, and into a terrace filled with grapevines. Young, very, very healthy looking grapevines. And now I'm sitting at the back of the little egg-shaped dome, and I think this will be a nice, comfortable place to carry on talking to you about the Pou de Albarqueta. So, according to the Catalan Dictionary of Catalunya, Valencia and the Balearics, the toponymy of Albarca, there are two different possibilities. One is that it means rustic leather shoes, and another possibility is the colloquial Arabic al-barca, which means blessing or blessed terrain. According to the local Ibethan folklorist Tony Manonelles, in an article that he wrote in 1997, this well has been known as the Pou de Albarqueta since at least 1728. And before that, it was apparently known as the Pou de Canamunt, another Arabic name for sure, although I don't know what it means. And it's unanimously understood that this well has existed since the Arabic era, which started in 900 after Christ. But the white egg shape, which I was just describing to you on the other side of the well, is definitely new. It's maximum 200 years old. And they say that originally this well was just an opening on ground level. So inside the well, this article by Tony Manonelles describes the pulley system, which I was just playing around with earlier, which is made out of wood, and the crossbar, which is carved out of olive. And he also mentions the rectangular water vessel, which is carved from sandstone. So apparently the depth of this well is around 40 palms, and earlier on when I was making these notes, I wasn't sure exactly what the measurement of a palm is. It seems to be quite a common measurement used in old Ibethan folkloric material. And from doing a bit of internet research, I discovered that one palm is either 20 centimetres, in which case this well is 8 metres deep, or a palm is 7.6 centimetres, in which case it's 3 metres deep. To be quite honest, after doing the little tryout with the water bottle a moment ago, which you heard, I'm pretty certain that it's 8 metres, so a palm is 20 centimetres. That water bottle definitely went down at least 8 metres. And apparently this is a well that no one remembers ever being dry. Which is interesting on reflecting on the meaning of the name Albarca, meaning blessing or blessed terrain. apparently, in the rainy season, the water level of this well rises so much that the water flows out through a hole at the back, which is actually very near to where I'm sitting now, and it feeds out into this terrace where I'm sat, which has now got some lovely, healthy young grapevines in it. But apparently the last time the water overflowed out through this hole, it flooded the terraces and several cherry trees died. If you've listened to my previous podcasts, you might agree with me that on Ibiza, it's pretty crazy to have a well with too much water in it. Indeed a blessing. In any case, 30 years after this article was written, and we're now, Ibiza has been in a pre-drought alert for a good year, and the island's aquifers, the island's underground water vaults, are currently standing at an alarming 36% full. And yet, as we just discovered, there's still a little amount of water at the bottom of this well. So Manoneas refers to this well as, in Ibizenco, a po de abeurada, from the verb beure, which is to drink. So that must mean that this is some kind of drinking hole, a place for collecting water for animals or for people. And he says that this well provided for the local neighbours. I can see a couple of houses over on the edges of the fields here, but also for other people coming from further afield. And this is really interesting because it seems like over the course of centuries, nothing has changed. Because this well unusually has so much water in it all year round, it is a well which often has people coming to it to collect drinking water. Quite often when I've gone past, I've seen a car parked and I've seen someone pulling up water. And indeed, there's always different types of plastic water bottles connected to the rope. And sometimes the water bottles seem to break. I think they fall down into the well, which is not good. So it's still today a regular drinking hole, which is quite miraculous, really, when you think about it. So apparently, back in 1919, a good century ago, there was a case of abuse of the well. People were coming and pulling up water from it so often that apparently the well water turned cloudy, and complaints were made to the mayor, I presume the mayor of San Juan, which is the nearest, the municipality that we're in. And the mayor decided on the action to take. He decided that it would still be fair for people to be able to come and drink from this well. However, he decided to somehow cordon it off, I suppose make some kind of fence around it, a distance away, so that people would have to leave their mule or their horse or their wagon a fair distance in order to come and get water from the well, thereby kind of controlling the use a little bit. So at this well, the Balpayés Ibizan folk dance has taken place, traditionally on the Catholic Saint's Day of Maria, which is the 5th of August. However, it stopped about 100 years ago, and apparently this was due to rivalry between the youth of nearby San Miguel and San Lorenzo, because apparently each group wanted to do the first dance here. A very serious issue. But apparently there was another dance organised here more recently, only in 1996, and it was organised harmoniously by the same San Miguel San Lorenzo youth. It was celebrating the restoration and the whitewashing of this well and the creation of the lovely cobbled square, which is still here today, which was a recent project that was carried out by an architect and two stone workers. And they began in July. The deadline was the St. Maria Catholic's Day on the 5th of August, and they completed it in time, so a big fiesta took place. According to the author of this article, Tony Manoneas, the result is one of the most beautifully restored wells of Ibiza. And I quote from him, he says, "Today, it isn't necessary to adopt a new architectural language justified by the cultural shifts that have taken place around us or the new technology we have at our disposal. Of course, these innovations can help us, but we shouldn't become a slave to them. These days, a dominant traditional architectural style is slowly being replaced by the coexistence of a range of contrasting styles. But this well is a wonderful example of how traditional methods can be embraced for humble, practical, and harmonious effect." And I completely agree with him. It's one of the most visually captivating wells that I know of. A gleaming white egg on the roadside. Is it a bird's egg? More on that later. But meanwhile, as I record this, and as the sun comes up over the hill and is now gleaming gorgeous and very gentle sunlight into my face for the moment, this episode is coinciding with the Nit de San Juan, the Night of St. John, which is the midsummer celebration that takes place here and in the rest of Spain. On the night that this episode will be launched, only 7 kilometres away from here, people of all ages and all backgrounds will gather together in the village of San Juan to jump the fires. A thrilling and exhilarating experience. It's a kind of a purification ritual, a casting away of the old into the flames and a crossing a threshold between one chapter and the next. And aside from the fire jumping on this night, there's another very important and wonderfully pagan ritual that also takes place on this night since 1973, organised by the Institut d'Estudis Ibicencs, the Institute of Ibican Studies, in a different location each year. It's a late night gathering involving music, performance, many different things, and it culminates in the late night reading of a manifesto. I love this, relating to the issues most important to this organisation, which represents many local Ibizan people very proud of their culture and their heritage. So some of the issues that they discuss in this manifesto are the preservation of Ibicenc, the locally spoken dialect of Catalan, the protection of the local environment and the cultural heritage. And just to share a tiny snippet from last year's manifesto, which is available on their blog, it addresses the very pressing and very debated topic of tourism. And incidentally, this little extract includes a fire-related metaphor, so I couldn't resist putting it in. It says, "We must stop trying to break visitor records with the mistaken belief that the more tourists, the better. We need to cool the economy if we do not want it to end up burning us." But after the heated manifestos have been recited and the fires have been jumped, there's a less known side of the Nit de San Juan, and it's relation to fresh waters and the wells. On this night, according to local legend, the freshwater sources and the wells are supposed to have special rejuvenating powers. Supposedly, there was a tradition to go and collect the first bucket of well water after the Nit de San Juan for its benevolent healing properties. And surely there's no stronger symbol for the renewing powers of well water than a huge, brilliant, white, gleaming egg, like the one beside me, shining with the first rays of the sun. Is it a bird's egg? So I've been kind of befriending this well because it's also very near to where I live. So many months ago, when this valley was still filled with thick foliage, long grasses and orange trees heavy with fruits, and when the mornings were filled with heavy mist and not these gentle rays of the sun which will soon get stronger and stronger, I saw a bird beside this well. It was a Barbary duck. I noticed it immediately. It had a very strong presence. It was plump, well-built, robust and strong. It had a pristine white breast, glossy black feathers down its back, and a large pink beak, and a strange look in its eye. Reminds me of that poem that I read when I first got here. So this egg-shaped well had a guardian beside it, and the guardian was a bird. And one winter's day in January, I returned and I sat here, and the bird came closer. I offered it some crumbs from a delicious mince pie I was eating. The bird got even closer. I gave it more. The bird seemed to be grateful, seemed to be bonding with me, seemed to be becoming friendly. And to me, it was the most magical thing in the world that, as I planned to do a podcast episode about birds, I had found an egg-shaped well with a bird guardian. So another day I came back looking for the bird, and I found it in the long grass, lifeless, that smooth, glossy body covered with gorgeous feathers was lying lifeless on the ground, on the roadside. Had it been hit by a car? Had it been attacked by a dog? I'll never know. Later, it seems one of the neighbours moved it away, and I never saw it again. So this is where this little story starts, at an egg-shaped well, flowing abundantly with the waters of life, flowing so abundantly that many moons ago, the cherry trees here were engulfed and drowned. And this is the gleaming white egg which was once guarded by a bird whose body became later a lifeless feathered mass beside the road. So this episode is dedicated to that bird, which became some kind of messenger, promising more if we were somehow able to decipher the symbols that the bird left us. This well had unexpectedly flipped from a place of fecundity and well-being to a place of grief and darkness. It brought to mind a poem by David White, The Well of Grief. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water cold and clear. Had this Barbary duck offered us an invitation to submerge ourselves fully in the well of grief in order to take us on some kind of necessary journey? Let's come back to that shortly. But first, a bit more of an immersion into the kingdom of these feathered and winged beings. All of the birdsong that you'll hear in this episode was recorded over the course of the past year, on my phone, in the north of Ibiza, mostly the area of San Lorenzo and San Juan, and at different times of the day, ranging from dawn till dusk, and occasionally at night.
And so I turn toward my partner or my lover and I say, gosh, I really love you, darling, but I'm just not feeling quite met because another human nervous system shaped just like my own can't possibly provide all of that rich, wild otherness we once got from hummingbirds and raven.
That was the writer and ecologist David Abram speaking at the Animate Earth Annual Confluence, an online event organised by the Animate Earth Collective in November 2024. In a book called The End of the End of the Earth, Essays, a man called Jonathan Franzen says, "One reason that birds matter is that they are our last best connection to a natural world that is otherwise receding. They're the most vivid and widespread representatives of the Earth as it was before people arrived on it." And on a very similar note, the book Les Balears Abans dels Humans, which means the Balearic Islands before humans, states, "Before the arrival of man, the Pitiuses, the pine tree islands known as Ibiza and Formentera, formed the most striking wildlife anomaly in the entire Mediterranean. It was the only territory with no land mammals, and the resulting community of vertebrates was made up almost entirely of birds." So, 6,000 years later, as explained by the writer Martin Davis in the introduction to the book Birds of Ibiza, with beautiful illustrations by Sarah Negchampin, Ibiza is still home to an exceptionally rich and varied population of birds. And actually, weirdly, this is partially thanks to tourism. Because of the decline in agriculture, the pine forests have spread all across abandoned farmland, and they're more extensive than they have been for centuries. So there are apparently at least 270 species of bird on Ibiza, ranging from all-year-round residents to those who stay part of the year, arriving to the island from colder northern lands in the winter, or migrating to Africa and the equator in winter and then spending their summer on the island. They're rather like feathered tourists, you could say. And as Martin Davis very accurately points out, Ibiza has been an international hub and island of migrants for over 6,000 years, if you count not only the human but also the bird populations that have come here. So this realm of birds that we have here, it seems that they're all either arriving or on their way off somewhere. No one is here to stay for good. Does that sound familiar to people who live here? So in the book Birds of Ibiza, edited by Martin Davis and with gorgeous paintings by Sarah Negchampin, there's a lovely description of the bee eater, a bird which comes to the Balearics in the late spring from North Africa on its way to mainland Spain. The description goes, "One morning I heard their musical warbling and knew they were close by. I walked up the hill until I was above them. There were about 20 birds hopping about in the field just below me, looking for insects and making a soft cooing sound. Suddenly they all rose up as one. The sound changed to their louder fluting call. They began to fly off. They were joined by more and more bee-eaters from other parts of the island. Their journey to the mainland had begun." And the dead Barbary duck that I found beside this well a couple of months ago was also not destined to stay. It felt like some kind of omen for these dark times that we're facing right now in the world, everything so tangled and messed up. And starting from there, and from the depths of this well, which we've now discovered is a good 8 metres deep, I thought we could go on a kind of mythical journey with the help of some bird companions, from this dark place to the skies high up above. And I thought we could do it with the help of 3 local birds, which will all appear at different stages of the journey. Shall we go? So, first of all, beginning here on ground level, I want to start with a bird whose agitated squawk fills the interior of the Ibizan countryside from the early hours of dawn into the evening. It's the cockerel, or gallo in Spanish and gall in Catalan. Now, it doesn't matter where you are on this island, there's always a cockerel. They're randomly crossing very, very busy roads. A couple of roundabouts on the edge of Ibiza town seem to be inhabited by cockerels. They're so ubiquitous that actually there's a theory that they are referenced in Ibiza's ancient folk dance, the bal payés, in the male traditional costume, which includes a floppy bright red hat, which is worn by the males, and it closely resembles the comb or the crest of the cockerel. But anyway, in this winged voyage that we're going on, from the darkness up to the light, up to the skies and the heavens, I wish to talk about a particular breed of Ibizan cockerel, the black cockerel, the gallo negro.
Cuando canta el gallo negro, es que ya se acaba el día. Cuando canta el gallo negro, es que ya se acaba el día. Si cantara el gallo rojo, otro gallo cantaría. Si cantara el gallo rojo.
Se encontraron en la arena, los dos gallos frente a frente. El gallo negro era grande, pero el rojo era valiente. They met on the sand, two cockerels face to face. The black cockerel was large, but the red cockerel was brave. Se miraron cara a cara y atacó el negro primero. El gallo rojo es valiente, pero el negro es traicionero. They looked each other in the face. The black one attacked first. The red one is brave, but the black one is a traitor. Ay, si es que yo miento, que el cantar que yo canto lo borre el viento. Ay, qué desencanto, si me borrara el viento lo que yo canto. Oh, if I lie, that the song I sing is erased by the wind. Oh, how sad it is that the wind erases this song that I sing.
Que el cantar que yo canto lo borre el viento. Ay, qué desencanto, si me borrara el viento lo que yo canto.
So this song, Gallo Rojo, Gallo Negro, was written in 1963 by the Spanish singer-songwriter Chico Sánchez Ferlosio, and it became an anti-Franco anthem during the Spanish Civil War, with the black cockerel representing the fascists and the red cockerel representing the republicans. Apparently the artist decided to transform this story he was singing into a bird metaphor so that he could transmit his message without being persecuted. So this transforming and shape-shifting is going to be a theme you'll discover with this journey that we're making through this series of birds. By transforming fascist nationalists and republicans into a set of cockerels, Ferlosio was able to write a song that would imprint itself into Spanish culture for the rest of history. And in fact, a beautiful rendition of this song features as a heart-wrenching finale to a film which came out lately in Spain called El 47, or The 47, which won 5 Goyas, and it portrayed the repression and the pain and the difficulties facing an immigrant neighbourhood in Barcelona in the decades after the Civil War. So meanwhile, back on the Balearic Islands, the writer Jorge Montojo, in his book Tras el Velo de Tanit, shares a very dark legend about black cockerels descending onto Ibiza's sister island, Formentera, an island which is more generally associated with radiant sunshine and gleaming white bohemian hippie dresses and sandy beaches. So Montojo's legend of Formentera tells of a man from the area of Escaló ascending up to the lighthouse at the end of the island, and this man was as foul and nasty as they get. His pastime at night time was to go out and light fires on the nearby coast to confuse fishermen trying to get home after fishing at night time. Those local fishermen who didn't drown after sinking on the nearby rocks, this man would kill himself with his bare hands as they climbed exhausted onto shore trying to save their lives. Finally, years later, as this man lay on his deathbed, the priest was called to Escaló, and as some villagers and a couple of cousins gathered around the deceased man lying in his coffin, a huge dark shadow crept across the sky behind them. Suddenly, a pair of gigantic black cockerels descended, flapping their wings with a furious roar, landing on each side of the coffin. The women of the village screamed and ran off looking hysterically for their husbands. But as the men arrived with their shotguns, the birds were gone. All that was left was an empty wooden coffin still rattling on the paving stones. So on our gentle journey with our bird companions up into the skies above, we're now going to elevate slightly from ground level. We're going to leave behind the cruel savagery of roosters and the human realm. And now we're just slightly above ground level. We're at the height of the treetops. And here we encounter our next bird companion. This bird is responsible for my favourite sound of the Ibethan night. It's a mysterious call that hypnotised me since my first winter here many years ago. It comes from a tiny little bird that measures no more than maximum 19 centimetres tall. It's a bird that is rarely seen. It stays hidden in the trees, in forested areas and the treetops, where its brown-toned feathers camouflage it completely against the bark. It's the Scops Owl. Now, this special bird has its roots, or perhaps the tree upon which this bird is perched has its roots, in the eastern Mediterranean, in Greece. The name of the Scops Owl derives from the Greek word to observe, skopeo. And on Ibiza, the locals refer to this solitary little bird as a musol. There's an old Catalan saying which is, qui viu tot sol sembla un musol, which means he who lives all alone is like a little Scops Owl. And another Ibizenco expression is estar como un musol, which refers to somebody who is sad. They're as sad as a Scops Owl. Over in Cyprus, the Scops Owl is said to be the most ancient of all birds. And from those lands, there comes a folktale which explains the story of this hidden bird of the Ibethan night with its haunting call. So the story goes that many moons ago, the Scops Owl was once a boy. Again, the transforming, shape-shifting nature of our bird companions. So the Scops Owl began as a boy, the son of a poor peasant family that lived on the edge of a big, dark, deep forest. And this boy, his task was to work the land for the family and to look after the sheep, whilst his younger brother looked after the beautiful horses. Now one day, a huge storm rolled in whilst his younger brother was in the forest with the horses. And when he came back, the older brother counted the horses and discovered that one was missing. He was furious, he was worried, and he ordered his brother back into the forest to find the missing horse. As his younger brother went alone, fearfully, into the forest with the storm raging above, the boy found the missing horse on nearby land. As the storm raged above, he ran into the forest, desperately looking for his brother, stricken with guilt and fear and worry. He searched the forest throughout the night, wailing and calling, but he never found his missing brother. And it is said that at some point, deep in the forest, the goddess Artemis, the goddess of the hunt, heard his call and came near. Struck by the sound of this unfamiliar bird that she'd never heard before. And when she eventually found a boy, she decided to transform his mournful cry into a bird song so that it could stay forever in the forest. And she turned the boy into a Scops Owl, which has inhabited the deep, dark forests of the Mediterranean ever since. So from wretched black birds transformed into men, men transforming into wretched black birds, and now a heartbroken boy transforming into an owl whose sad call touches all those who hear it today. So with the help of the Scops Owl, we've left the ground level of wretched men and black birds, and we now find ourselves in the treetops, waiting for our final companion to help us soar high into the skies. So which mythical bird will firmly take us away from the realm of darkness, up into the cosmos and the heavens? Now I turn to a quote which I think I shared in the very first episode of this podcast, written by a figure who's become something of a patron saint of this podcast, actually. The architect, historian, writer, poet and mystic Rolf Blackstad, the original founder of the architecture company Blackstad Ibiza. And This extract is taken from his collection of journal-like writings called Ibiza, A World Forgotten, which was originally published by White Ibiza magazine. The following is an account of Rolf's encounter in about the 1960s with a well not far from here, about 2 kilometres away, and one which will be familiar with podcast listeners because it's where I recorded episode 5. It's the Font de Camperemuson in San Lorenzo. So, 60 years ago, Rolf wrote, "Into the cave, a few steps down, a pool of water, an underground spring. I entered the cave. The scene was dreamlike. My body dematerialized. I vanished to myself. I remember nothing further, not my return journey through the valley in darkness. The place was the Spring of Balafi, an Arab name meaning Fountain of Blessed Waters. I soon visited it again after my strange initial encounter and painted a dove in blue line inside the inner chamber of the fountain. It remained there for some years. At the time, I did not realise that I was following immemorial precedent, that years later I would find another fountain with an ancient painted chamber with an image of the sun in the same relative position as I had painted the dove. The meaning of the dove and the sun in this context is the same." So, it's absolutely no coincidence that under a kilometre away from the well where Rolf Blakstad painted this dove in blue line 60 years ago, there's a popular restaurant called La Paloma, which means the dove in Spanish. Listening to a podcast interview with the Italian family that runs the restaurant a couple of years ago, they shared the story about why they named their restaurant La Paloma. Rolf Blakstad had been a good friend of theirs, and as they prepared to open the restaurant, he told them that he had had a vision of a white dove flying over Balafia, and that that's the name that they should call their new business. The restaurant has carried that name for 20 years ever since. So what is the missing link connecting the dove, the symbol of the sun, and the well of Balafia, a tiny ancient settlement at the heart of the island which has not one, but 2 springs? I don't think it's a huge leap to say that the link is evident as soon as we remember Ibiza's wells via the lens of ancient history and mythology, as sacred monuments representing abundance, life force, health and regeneration, sites at which over the course of 2,000 years people have come to commune with the goddess associated with this island since the Phoenicians settled here, the goddess Tanit. Across the Eastern Mediterranean, the Middle East and Africa, Tanit carries names including the goddess of the heavenly upper world, the lady of heaven, the shining one, and, interestingly, the dove and the solar disk, or the symbol of the sun, are 2 symbols which are commonly featured in her headdress. So the question is Balafia the site where a white dove shapeshifts into the island's mother goddess? Is the goddess of Ibiza a bird? As an African goddess, Tanit is closely linked with Isis, the sky goddess, often depicted with wings. The many 100 fragments of terracotta figures that were excavated from Esquiram, the Ibizan cave sanctuary known as Tanit's Cave, all depict Tanit as the figure of a woman whose body is cloaked by an enormous set of wings. Is it possible that in the end, the most sacred deities of this island of migrants are winged and feathered? In a blog called Feminism and Religion, the writer Carol P. Christ writes, "According to Maria Gimbutas, the bird is one of the most common images of the goddess of old Europe. Birds are universally admired for their powers of flight. Think of the Holy Spirit descending as a dove. The days marked by the return of birds in spring and their departure at the end of the summer were correlated with planting and harvesting. A bird egg is a symbol of fertility, a bird nest, a symbol of home, and the care and concern of birds for their young is a model for parenting. To paraphrase Black Elk, because it means all of this and so much more, the bird is sacred. And meanwhile, in world religions, European mythology, medieval literature, and the occult, the language of the birds is said to be a mystical, perfect, divine language used by birds to communicate with the initiated. In the Kabbalah, Renaissance magic, and alchemy, the language of the birds was considered a secret and perfect language, and the key to perfect knowledge, sometimes also called green language. A Lebanese goddess chant repeats the following phrase: "There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings." Now, you may have noticed that there are no interviews in this episode. Quite unusual, first time, I think. I reached out to a couple of people quite recently, a little bit too last minute, and none of them were available because summer had arrived and things were getting busy and intense. So one person who I had reached out to feature in this episode was a woman called Athoul Thomé, a French-Lebanese artist and activist based in the UK who had spent some time on Ibiza a decade ago, just after I'd moved here, and we'd spent some time together. And for her, it was very meaningful, her brief stay on this island, whose original settlers had sailed here from what is now Lebanon, ancient Phoenicia. Through her various artistic and activist projects, Athoul seemed to be on a journey to reconnect with her origins and her ancestry. And later on, a particular creative project of hers really caught my attention. She made a set of beautiful terracotta Phoenician bird goddesses, winged deities, leading her on a migratory route back to her Lebanese homeland. I'd so wanted to talk to her about this, but a week or so ago, I had a brief exchange with Athoul, and it was clear that it was going to be impossible for her to be involved. A couple of days later, she was departing to Egypt to take part in a migration of a different kind, but heading to exactly the same geographical destination, the global march to Gaza. Somehow those beautiful, deep red terracotta bird goddesses, the colour of the Ibizan earth, close the circle of the journey that we've been on. A journey that started with such darkness and death, reflecting these times that we're in right now, and leading to a migratory journey back to healing and love. So there we are. We started with the dead bird beside an egg-shaped well. And we've risen from the depths to the domain of the white dove, the winged goddess, thanks to our shape-shifting feathered friends. They've taught us about transformation, transcendence, healing, and maybe hope. Well, it's now almost 9 a.m. and it feels like I've been up for 5 hours. The sun is positioned way up above the carob tree off to my left, and I'm feeling pretty warm already. It's going to be a hot day for sure. And the little winding road that goes past the Pod El Barqueta has got regular cars going up and down it now, making me realise that dawn is a very appealing time to be up and about with the birds. And as a final serenade to the birds, I think words escape me, and all I'm left with are some final snippets of local literature in the form of some classic pop rock hits from the 80s, which they always play again and again on the local Ibethan radio station, Kiss FM. Love lifts us up where we belong, where the eagles cry on a mountain high. What about this one? Take these broken wings and learn to fly again. Learn to live so free. When we hear the voices sing, the book of love will open up and let us in.
Que de tu estic agraïda.